I wasn't with Ray and Mika the first time the world around me didn't seem real. I was walking down the street in town. Two college-age women passed. They looked at me strangely. I realized my mouth was open and I'd been staring. They didn't seem real. Neither did the bricks I stepped on or the library I passed. Later that night, at home, I stood before the bathroom mirror washing my face. The stripes on my turtleneck started to blend. I could see through it and my torso. I was disappearing. By my next appointment with Dr. B, I was certain I was losing my mind. He wrapped the blood pressure cuff around my upper arm. As he pumped the gauge and it closed around my bicep, my arm felt numb. The room and he seemed far away. "Derealization," he said when I told him. "And like I don't have a body," I said. "Depersonalization," he said. I asked if it was normal. "It can be," he said, "for someone with your diagnoses." I try to imagine the Swiss philosopher and professor Henri-Frédéric Amiel on July 8, 1880, the year before his death, seated on the stiff-backed chair at his desk. The white in his long goatee doesn't age him, or it's the plumpness of his cheeks that makes him look so young. But he's aging. It shows in what he writes, his wistful late-life reflections and inability to remember. "I am depersonalized, detached, cut adrift." "It's not madness," he says, "because madness is the point at which recovering balance is no longer possible, and the capacity for self-judgment and self-control have gone." For Amiel, to be depersonalized was a philosophical state, a moment of contemplation. As a psychological term, depersonalization, coined at the end of the 19th century, isn't just philosophical self-strangeness. It's madness, a pathological state of extreme detachment. One observes oneself from the outside with none of the enlightenment Buddhists with similar awareness claim. Identity and personality dissolve, leaving the person in darkness. Its counterpart is derealization. The world feels unreal. Time distorts. People and objects drift. Life appears to be simulated. Hadn't I experienced depersonalization and derealization before? Wasn't that the scrim between me and my classmates on that eighth grade field trip? The sense of falling away as a migraine came on, the disinterestedness while envisioning my suicide in the bathtub in Chicago, the abandonment present while leaving the hospital after Cappy died, the dark dislocation of living in the Grant Wood House? Diagnoses, plural. If I could go back, I'd tell my 39-year-old self to slow down. Consider for a moment if you can trust that you have multiple mental illnesses. I'd tell her that the comorbidity rate in psychiatric diagnoses is extremely high and continues to increase with each edition of the DSM, which could imply that the shifting symptom lists and additions of new diagnoses make people easier to diagnose. My 39-year-old self might have argued that comorbidity occurs in physical illnesses and is increasing too. Yes, I'd say, but those illnesses are illnesses. Those diseases are actual diseases. They're valid. Technically, I had one comorbid disorder, ADHD and OCD. Only ADHD and OCD were accompanied by codes, 314.01, 300.3. My depressive, anxious elements were a bonus. Comorbidity, having two or three or four diagnoses, isn't rare. In 2005, a study found that nearly half the subjects had been diagnosed with more than one mental illness. Another study analyzed the frequency of comorbid diagnoses and found that it was the rule, not the exception. It's not entirely clear if the high rate of comorbidity is the result of inflated diagnoses or a causal relationship among disorders, e.g., anxiety causes depression or vice versa. But given that DSM diagnoses can't be proven, it's not possible to say that one causes another. The move toward multiple diagnoses started with the DSM-3 with its abundance of disorders and overlapping symptom lists, a kind of net psychiatry cast to make sure no one slipped through it without a diagnosis. In some ways, my comorbidity made sense. ADHD and OCD share similar symptoms. So do ADHD and anxiety, and OCD and anxiety, and anxiety and depression. Depression and ADHD are associated in that there's much speculation that one causes the other. Depression makes you distractible, and ADHD is depressing. Once a patient is in the maze of and, ADHD and OCD and depression and anxiety, instead of or, ADHD slash OCD slash depression slash anxiety, it's hard to get out. The either-or factor doesn't come into it. At a water park, on what the brochure referred to as a monster water slide, the flimsy yellow raft beneath me bobbed in the water. Ray and Mika and Mika's friend were waiting for me at the bottom. Ray had arranged this trip for us to spend time together. Lying on my back on the raft, I waited my turn. The boy in front of me in line, his eyes bright with excitement, held on to the side of the slide. I did too. When it was his turn, he launched his raft forward and disappeared down the slide. I'd avoided participating in the water park's activities for most of the weekend. I had to work. While Ray and Mika and Mika's friend sloshed down water slides and lolled in the lazy river, I stayed in the hotel room and wrote a book review due to the New York Times. It would have been fine if I'd spent the whole time writing, but I also found myself pacing the parking lot for seemingly no reason. Something wasn't right. I was edgy, unable to sit still. That morning, I'd told them I'd go with them. I wanted to be normal, stable, someone with structure. Which is how I ended up on a flimsy yellow raft with the girl behind me bobbing on her own yellow raft, telling me it was my turn. The balding man behind her scowled at me with a hurry-up nod of his chin. No way back, no options. I let go and drifted toward the slide's mouth. 9. Becoming bipolar. Ray and I sat at the kitchen table. It was a Saturday morning. We each had a cup of coffee. The French press was between us. Looking bright and happy, like someone bursting with news, he asked what kind of ring I'd want if he were to ask me to marry him. We'd moved in together, albeit long distance. Technically, I still lived in Iowa. During the week, I taught, staying at the campus hotel, which gave faculty a discount and was cheaper than renting an apartment. On weekends, I paid $25 round trip to ride the megabus 4 hours to Chicago. Ray would be waiting in his gray pickup truck at Union Station when my bus arrived. He'd have on the baseball hat he wore so often I sometimes forgot what color his hair was. It was blonde. He was balding. As I climbed in, he'd look at me sidelong as if I was the sexiest woman he'd ever met. "Well, hello," he'd say. I didn't know what kind of ring I'd want. I didn't wear jewelry and hadn't thought about marriage since Chris. Although I'd been socially conditioned in a country where marriage was still very much the norm, I was solitary but well-liked and hadn't kept up with friends and had attended maybe 2 weddings in my adult life. Never a bridesmaid, never have to be a bride. Children either. Them I'd sworn off at 13 when I declared as much to my mother. If I was created only to bear children, as some insisted, that didn't mean I had to do it. Many, many women had assured me I'd change my mind. I hadn't. But the idea of marrying Ray seemed like a good one. I loved him. I loved Mika. Being in a step-parent role came surprisingly easily. Basically, I stayed out of it, no matter what it was. I deferred to Ray and Mika's mother. And I understood that although Mika and I were friends in a step-parentish way, she sometimes wished I didn't exist so she could have her dad to herself. Marriage was normal, stable, a structure. If I were married, it would mean I was solid, grounded, not someone who felt herself cracking again. I had my diagnoses. I had my medications. Never mind that I had to hold myself together all weekend only to sob on the bus back to Iowa. I'd be fine. Everything would be fine. Christmas night at our apartment. We sat on the bed and exchanged presents. A small fake tree stood on the dresser. In the glow of the string of lights, he thanked me for the workout pants and shirts I'd gotten him. He'd never once exercised, but had, of late, spoken of it interestedly, like it was an exotic food. Live cobra heart or century eggs. He might someday like to try. After a comedic pause that implied there wasn't a gift for me, he went to the other room. My uneasiness had nothing to do with him. The splintering was accompanied by other symptoms, as I'd started to call them. The cracking feeling, the sense that I was going to break down, The sodden pit, which somehow had taken on the same hue as the murky pit from my teenage years, compounding it. I took my pills. I kept my charts and a calendar and a journal. I did what someone with a comorbid diagnosis with features and elements was supposed to do. It wasn't working. He came back into the room holding what looked like, and was, a gift-wrapped mop. My stomach didn't sink. My shoulders relaxed. I laughed, genuinely, and pretended to be surprised after I pulled off the wrapping. "A mop," I said. From his pocket, he pulled out a Tiffany box. His chronic pain didn't allow him to get down on one knee. He opened the box to show me the ring and asked me to marry him. It was one of those teasing marriage proposals that winks to the phoniness of the wedding industry and plays with the ridiculousness of what had become a commercialized ritual at best. But there were many reasons to say yes. His fortitude and humor, his talent, how devoted he was to Mika, and the chance to be Mika's stepmother. Solid. Grounded. Not cracking. Yes. We were at Target buying something for the apartment when the shift occurred. Or maybe it had already occurred and the breaking down and cracking had reached a crisis point. We might have been shopping for a bookshelf, maybe a shower curtain. Whatever it was, I wanted one brand, Ray another. I turned and walked away. When I was out of sight in another aisle, I started to pace. The splintering. My medications weren't working. They couldn't be. Ray appeared at the end of the aisle looking for me. I pretended to be comparing towel brands. In my hand was an off-white towel, which would have lasted about 4 seconds with the dust and grime Ray brought home with him from his job. In the car, he asked what had happened. I couldn't tell him it was from 2 months of wanting to stay and needing to leave. 2 months of holding back the pressure of my attention deficit disorder / OCD features with some depressive anxious elements. 2 months of trying to be part of a family with all the intimacy and vulnerability and exposure that entailed, and at the same time trying to hide. So I said, "I don't know." That Monday, with the sun rising in the city, cloaking the buildings in a cloudy dawn light, I boarded the megabus. The splintering that had been building all weekend split. Tears, sobs, in public, unable to stop. Ray changed, too. When I met him, he seemed to have gotten over the 2008 financial crisis that had bankrupted him. He was working again after spending 9 months collecting unemployment and watching the news, obsessing about the banks being bailed out and executives being offered bonuses. The 2008 crisis had triggered something in him. He'd grown up poor. His father had been bankrupted by the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s and 1990s, when greedy SNL executives defrauded American taxpayers. It had seemed that although the financial crisis had been painful, Ray wasn't consumed by it anymore. And then he was. He started to listen to audiobooks about it. His voice grew more bitter and menacing with each one. He talked endlessly about the corrupt CEOs and hedge fund managers. Bernie Madoff, Lehman Brothers, the SEC, laissez-faire free market economics, former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, and Jamie Dimon. He loathed Jamie Dimon. His paintings became darker, swirls of thick black and green paint, a 15-foot-long canvas of heads piled up, each representing an American who'd been bankrupted. One night, he stayed up late painting in his studio, drinking wine and listening to another audiobook about the financial crisis. I'd kissed him goodnight. He didn't react, so intent was he on the dark painting before him. I was half asleep when he came to bed. He said something about Google Maps. Then, "I'm seriously thinking of going to that guy's house and shooting that motherfucker." I asked who he was talking about. He named one of the CEOs who'd glided out of the chaos protected by a golden parachute worth millions. Ray had found his address in the Chicago suburbs. "I'm going to kill him," he said. I believed him. "Ray, you just made me an accomplice. If I don't tell someone, if it weren't for Mika," he said, his voice hollow, "I'd do it." The next day, I packed what I needed and left. Months later, I sat in the hallway of the English Philosophy Building in Iowa City, waiting to be called into a room to defend my dissertation. Two undergraduate students passed by, the heel of one of their boots squeaking on the linoleum floor. I wasn't nervous, but I should have been. My breakup with Ray had been swift. The night I left our apartment, I expected to splinter, but I moved back to Iowa full-time into a room in a house with five roommates I barely knew. It was cheap and easy. I focused on finishing my dissertation, which I did in 3 months. My thesis advisor came out of the conference room and called me in. I sat at the other end of a long table. On the other side sat my committee, five male professors. I hadn't considered how the dynamics of that would play out. They questioned me and attacked my dissertation. The argument was weak. The argument didn't carry through, or as one professor, flustered behind his white beard, put it, he couldn't even find the argument. I started to shake and fumble my words. A dissertation defense is just that, a defense, which means there's something or someone to defend against. The point was to knock holes in my argument and for me to defend it. But I wasn't prepared. I hadn't asked the other grad students what their defenses had been like. Googling doctoral defense, what like, never crossed my mind. And my MFA thesis, defense, though it's hard to call a creative thesis that, had been a veritable love fest. Just when I thought I might cry, one of my committee members praised the original research I'd done. Another extolled the writing. They agreed. It was one of the most well-written dissertations they'd ever read. Not a single comma error in there. I made sure of that. Then, somehow, their praise became proof of my dissertation's inadequacy. It was so well written that concentrating on the writing must have distracted me from the argument. When the defense was over, I sat in the hallway on the same bench and waited for their deliberations to finish. My hands still shook. I eyed the stairwell at the end of the hall and considered walking out and never coming back. My advisor called me into his office. I stood across from his desk and waited. "Well," he said, exhaling and sitting down, "you passed." I asked if it was supposed to be like that. He shook his head. "They were particularly rough on you. I don't know why." I left the building and walked out into the chilly fall air. As I headed up the hill on campus, I called my mother and told her. She had a PhD and was overjoyed. When I described how rough it had been, she said, "It doesn't matter. They can never take those three letters away from you." We ended the call. The splintering sharpened. Classes let out. Students streamed out of buildings and onto the walkway. I hurried away onto the grass as if by bumping into one of them, I might break. In my interpretation of literature class the following week, a few students had their hands raised to answer the question I'd asked about Toni Morrison's novel, Beloved. I tried not to praise the literature I taught, letting students have their preferences, but they'd heard me go on about Morrison's novel. It's wrenching and one of the most exquisite novels ever written. Gripping plot, finely honed dialogue, richly built characters. Though that sounds trite. No summary does it justice. But it centers on a former slave, Setha, who escapes a plantation only to be found by her master. Setha is based on Margaret Garner, who escaped from slavery in 1856. To save her children from being recaptured, Setha tries to kill them, succeeding in killing her oldest, whose tombstone reads, "Beloved." I asked about Setha's monologue in the chapter we were reading. We'd gone over how the novel follows African-American vernacular English, AAVE, grammar and punctuation rules. Some of the students thought it was bad English or slang, but I explained that AAVE has a distinct set of rules. One mentioned how Setha says of her daughter, "she my daughter," instead of "she's my daughter," and "she mine," instead of "she's mine." I said it was as if the apostrophe, the possessive, is unnecessary. The student said how that made it seem like they had this super intense bond. At the end of class, as the students gathered their things, I put my whiteboard markers in my bag. By the time I got back to my office, the splintering had reached a pitch. But discussing Morrison's novel made me ask what I, someone with freedom and an income and so much privilege, had to be so upset about. Nothing was wrong. I'm exaggerating. I'm making too big a deal out of nothing. I might have believed that if I hadn't started crying and dancing in public. The splintering would intensify until it gushed out in tears I couldn't hold back. Sometimes a high-pitched energy possessed me, and I'd be so revved up and affected by the music I was listening to on my iPod that I danced in the street. After I'd come down, shame filled me. What if my students had seen? My colleagues? Heavy and unnerved, I pretended it wasn't happening. We like to romanticize, even glamorize DSM diagnoses. The bipolar artist, the alcoholic writer, the drug-addicted movie star, the schizophrenic genius. A favorite is to anachronistically diagnose artists and writers who were long dead before the diagnoses existed. The Dutch post-impressionist painter Vincent van Gogh died by suicide and has been posthumously diagnosed with many of the DSM's offerings: bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, anxiety disorder, and non-suicidal self-injury disorder. How could he epitomize these different diagnoses, two of which conflict? Bipolar and schizophrenia are considered mutually exclusive, except in the case of schizoaffective disorder, which is a separate diagnosis. He can because of two women, Nancy Andreasen and Kay Redfield Jameson. Along with her mental illness as brain disease proclamations, Andreasen ushered the writer with a mental illness stereotype into scientific literature. Before becoming a psychiatrist, she was a professor of Renaissance literature in the same PhD program where I was enrolled, though not at the same time, and was, by her own account, interested in examining how mental illness seemed to be more common in writers and if creativity was genetic. Her 1974 study supposedly proved just that. Writers have a higher rate of mental illness, whether they've been diagnosed or not. It runs in their families, and their family members are more creative too. Of the 15 successful creative writers, what exactly qualifies a writer as successful, she doesn't say, she wrote, "There is, emphasis hers, an association between genius and psychiatric disorder." In the same vein, her 1987 study concluded, "There is a close association between mental illness and creativity." Kay Redfield Jameson, the psychologist and celebrity author, brought Andreasen's theories into the mainstream. Jameson is often referred to as a psychiatrist, but she has no medical degree. In 1987, she surveyed 47 artists and authors of the British Royal Academy, 38% of whom had been treated for a mood disorder, which she extrapolated meant they had a mental illness. She helped solidify the public perception of mental illness as artistic, even sexy, with her subsequent book and memoir. Her 1993 book, Touched with Fire, Manic Depressive Illness and the Artistic Temperament, reinforced the misconception that crazy is synonymous with brilliance and artistic genius. Jameson relies primarily on speculation based on biographical information and correspondence. Citing pedigree, genetics, she argues that Lord Byron, Alfred Lord Tennyson, Henry James, Herman Melville, and Vincent van Gogh had manic depression. It's extremely difficult to imagine Henry James manic. In An Unquiet Mind, a memoir of moods and madness, Jameson shows her struggles with bipolar, but she varnishes them, dramatizing both ends of the bipolar spectrum so they gleam. Her depressive moods are tragic, and her manic experiences are ecstatic and beautifully seductive. It's tempting to argue that connecting mental illnesses to creativity and genius lessens the stigma. Science journalist Claudia Kalb claims as much in her book, Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Minds of History's Great Personalities, in which she anachronistically diagnoses Albert Einstein with autism and Marilyn Monroe with borderline personality disorder. She writes, "My hope is that telling these stories will highlight the psychological challenges we all face, no matter how big or small, and maybe even eradicate some of the cultural stigma that can go along with them." Andreasen and Jameson may have felt similarly, but a sensationalized view of mental illness could make someone more willing to accept or embrace an invalid, unproven DSM diagnosis. If not me, then a teenage girl who has been told by a school psychologist she has ADHD or generalized anxiety disorder or depression or bipolar disorder or all four. On too cold a fall morning to be outside for long, I sat on a bench on the pedestrian mall. The cold made my teeth chatter. The outdoor promenade, where students and residents often crowded, was empty of people. Tears streamed down my cheeks. I hovered near hysterics, then fell into them. The suicidal thoughts came regularly and then often. The usual, "I can't do this anymore, this is never going to end, I want to die." They were strongest, not at night, but mid-morning and in the afternoon, often at the campus recreation center after I'd spent an hour on a stair machine or treadmill, trying to sweat them away. I stopped crying long enough to go to my appointment with my therapist, Angela. I'd been seeing her since the depression diagnosis from Dr. B. People said people with depression needed therapy, so I went. The crying she'd witnessed, the suicidal thoughts she knew nothing about. She was young, with smiling eyes and a voice that reminded me of a cooing dove. I sat in the client's chair, she opposite me in her desk chair. After some time, therapists like to let you cry, she asked me to talk about it, if I could. "Nothing's wrong," I said. "That's what I don't understand." I'd passed my dissertation defense. I wasn't sad about Ray anymore. She asked what else might be causing me to feel the way I did. The crying started again. It seemed not to come from myself. Then I seemed not to be myself, watching myself in the chair and Angela across from me. I said I didn't want to be there anymore. Angela clarified, "Where? Here? In the office? Or?" I tried to answer, but couldn't. Heaves. Sobs. Ridiculous.
"Have you had these thoughts before?" she asked.
I said I had. Our session ended. She made me promise to call every day to check in until our next appointment. "I'm responsible for you." I went to class. I taught. I ran. I wrote. I walked. I ate. I called and checked in. At my next appointment, Angela asked how I was doing. "Worse," I said. She stood and in a gentle voice said she'd be right back.
"Don't go anywhere."
I started to cry again. Angela returned.
"We're lucky she's free."
"Who?" Angela led me down the hall to the office of the psychiatrist in her practice. The psychiatrist's office was painted teal. In her 50s, the psychiatrist had long brown hair and wore a suit jacket, a skirt, and heels. She introduced herself, though I can't remember her name. I sat on the couch. Angela stayed in the room. From the psychiatrist's mouth came questions I tried to answer. I measured my words, modulating my voice so that the words didn't sound alarming. It backfired, and I devolved into hysterics more extreme than if I'd let myself cry. When I calmed down and looked up, she surprised me. "You don't have ADHD, or OCD, or anxiety, or depression. You're bipolar." An exclamation point shouts, and in shouting demands attention. By nature, it cries out with emotion. It's a marker of excitability. It also creates a sense of urgency. It's an interjection, "Wait," and an imperative, "Stop." It can signify danger. The prevailing theory is that it was derived from the Latin word io, meaning an exclamation of joy like hooray in the 15th century. Supposedly, though the motivation for this isn't clear, a Roman started writing the I, Romans used all caps, over the O. The O shrank by degrees, eventually giving us a line and a dot, exclamation point. The exclamation point didn't have its own key on the QWERTY keyboard until 1970. Prior to that, to exclaim a point required effort. You had to type a period, backspace, and then type an apostrophe. It took 40 years for the exclamation point to become the hackneyed feature of texts and emails. A salutation has to be followed by one, "Hello." Simple statements get 3, even 4, "Can't wait till my next appointment," 1, 2, 3, 4 exclamation points. Women are expected to use it more often than men. It's gendered as a symbol of girlish gushiness. But it still has the potential to startle, disrupt, and frighten, to indicate extreme pain and fear, to alarm. The psychiatrist smoothed her slacks and stood. "I think you should see one of my colleagues." She went to the phone on her desk. "Who?" I asked, panic in my voice. The psychiatrist didn't answer. I looked at Angela, whose dove eyes had in them only sympathy. When the psychiatrist hung up, she said, "We can go."
"Where?"
I asked. She and Angela drove me to a private hospital called Mercy. The irony of the name was lost on me at the time. I was being escorted, that was clear. An image of my mother and me in the cab on the way to the eating disorders unit so long ago came to me. I was scared. I wanted to ask if I'd be able to go home that night. We entered the hospital's locked inpatient psychiatric ward.
The psychiatrist and Angela led me to the receptionist. Am I being checked in? The psychiatrist said, you'll see someone and decide together. She and Angela said goodbye. The psychiatrist was all business. Angela looked worried and a little relieved. I was shown to the day room with the other patients. It had none of the melodrama usually imparted to psych wards in movies and in books. The TV on the wall was muted. Four guys sat at a table playing cards. They didn't even look depressed. On a side table were coffee and tea. The hospital must always be that calm if the staff didn't worry about anyone throwing hot liquid on them or each other, I thought. The room was so quiet that for a moment, I wanted to stay. The room I was assigned had two beds. Panic filled me. Am I going to have a roommate? I asked the nurse. It wasn't a hotel moment. I wasn't telling the management the room didn't please me. Sleeping in a room with someone in the same space, with the world so unreal and me disappearing, was impossible. I'd crack for good. The nurse offered me a benzodiazepine. Valium? I asked. Alprazolam. When I didn't respond, she smiled. Xanax. I don't want that. Can I see the doctor? After she was gone, I sat on the bed. The thoughts of suicide seemed so irrelevant now that I was being faced with a locked ward. Were they really that serious? They had to be. I was bipolar. The lack of validity of DSM diagnoses and its unstable symptom lists produce statistics that are concerning and absurd. They don't actually tell us the number of Americans with mental disorders. All the statistics really say is that 26% or 21% or whatever percentage you want to believe of American adults receive an invalid, likely unreliable, invented DSM diagnosis or two each year. These statistics are batted about by the media and mental health organizations and on social media as if they're legitimate. Never mind that the diagnoses aren't provable, the statistics don't take the severity of disability into account. The DSM-5 doesn't assess the level of impairment. Depression is depression. Someone with 5 of 9 symptoms has the same diagnosis as someone with all 9. Being a little down is the same as being so depressed as to be suicidal. As others have pointed out, that's like treating a patient with stage 1 cancer the same as one with stage 4 cancer that's metastasized. The DSM only perfunctorily takes the degree and severity of a person's suffering into account. More compelling statistics come from the NIMH, which at least distinguishes between the rates of any mental illness, AMI, and serious mental illness, SMI. Though some define serious mental illness by diagnosis, like bipolar, schizophrenia, and treatment-resistant depression, the NIMH defines it as serious functional impairment. At least the NIMH's rates of mental illness are more discerning. Although 20% of American adults reported any diagnosis, AMI, only 5% had a serious mental illness, SMI. Regardless, the numbers, like the diagnoses, are skewed. How can so many people have DSM diagnoses? The DSM has made it so. The doctor, Dr. C, entered the room. He was young and self-assured. His head was shaved to a pleasant stubble. I remember him being handsome. Something in his face said he wouldn't lie. Maybe it was his confidence or my neediness, the knowledge that I was at risk and only he could save me or set me free. He sat on the chair across from me and asked questions similar to those the other psychiatrist had asked. When we'd finished, he leaned forward and rested his elbows on his knees. You have bipolar disorder. His tone said I should have known. Should have been able to identify the highs and lows for what they were, the crying, the dancing. His tone wasn't harsh. In fact, it was supportive. How could I have survived 10 or 15 years without the appropriate treatment? How could I have hidden my illness for that long? How could I have managed my bipolar disorder without help? My bipolar disorder. Bipolar is all about extremes. The bipolar patient shifts between two states. Depression and mania. In mania, she's been described as fitting one of two subtypes, euphoric, grandiose, or paranoid destructive. In depression, she's simply depressed. Bipolar has been identified by different names and as having different causes, all of which have been grim.
Hippocrates and the ancient Greeks identified it as the fluctuation between an excess of black and yellow bile. It had the distinct pleasure of being referred to as circular insanity by the French psychiatrist Jean-Pierre Fauré in 1851. Kraepelin called it manic depressive insanity in 1899, grouping all mood states, depressive, manic, and mixed, on a spectrum. Our modern concept of the illness didn't start until 1966, when Jules Angst, a Swiss psychiatrist, and Carlo Peres, a Swedish psychiatrist, distinguished unipolar depression, just depression, from bipolar depression, depression with mania. But the distinction made between unipolar and bipolar depression and the many subtypes and categories invented over the half century that followed didn't make bipolar a scientifically reliable diagnosis. Unipolar and bipolar depression can look alike, especially in someone who's high energy, e.g., me. It can be hard to tell if a patient is experiencing an extremely low mood with some days or weeks of reprieve, unipolar depression, or low mood with days or weeks of manic highs, bipolar disorder. The DSM's definition of bipolar changed over the five editions. The DSM-1 considered manic depressive reaction, as it was called, a psychotic condition with a psychological cause, not a physical one. Marked by severe mood swings, it could also include delusions and hallucinations. The DSM-2 renamed it manic depressive illness, characterizing it in terms of mood shifts unrelated to life events: manic, depressed, and circular. Manic type presented with elation, irritability, talkativeness, and increased activity with few bouts of depression. Depressed type resembled what I experienced: extremely low mood, apprehension, and agitation. Circular meant a mix of manic and depressive symptoms. The DSM-3 renamed it bipolar disorder and created more rigid categories for what constituted a manic, a depressive, or a mixed episode. The DSM-4 invented a brand new, unproven diagnosis, bipolar 2. In the DSM-5, bipolar disorder was given its own category, no longer binned among other mood and affective disorders, creating a bipolar spectrum. Depressive symptoms I had in spades: low energy, agitation, a sense of worthlessness, loss of interest in life, except for teaching, yes, insomnia, suicidality. Mine had come on fast and without cause, a hallmark of bipolar. But had I been manic? For signs of mania, the psychiatrist and Dr. C would have found few. Distractible, that word again. Hyperactive, a little, is that possible? Markedly energetic, perhaps. Experiencing flights of ideas, yes. Feeling as though I didn't need sleep. I wasn't sleeping, but need was a separate issue. That didn't seem to matter. The psychiatrist and Dr. C saw in me someone with bipolar disorder. I could either become it or not. Sitting across from Dr. C, I listened to the wind outside. Tree branches knocked against the window. Bipolar. I wanted out. "Please," I said, "don't make me stay here." He eyed me and asked if I thought I was a danger to myself. I shook my head. "I'm fine." He leaned back in his chair. "Given the thoughts you've been having, but I can't keep you here." I didn't have a plan, no clear way to end my life. "The thoughts are gone. For now," he said, "I'll be fine." He looked at me sidelong. "What will you do?" "Laundry," I said. Never had I wanted to do laundry so much. Something methodical, predictable, real. "That's a good sign," he said, and smiled. I walked down Bloomington Street, trying to understand how the psychiatrist and Dr. C had made the leap from ADHD and OCD and depression and anxiety to bipolar disorder. If two psychiatrists had said it, it must be true. That meant my primary care physician had been wrong. For years and years. When I got home, one of my roommates, a German undergraduate student, was in the kitchen. Her long hair hung down almost to her waist. She smiled and held aloft a pint of Häagen-Dazs vanilla ice cream. Did I want a bowl? It was such a simple question, such an ordinary action. Eat a bowl of ice cream. I'd just been in a locked ward because I'd considered ending my life. how to reconcile that alongside her scooping sweet vanilla ice cream into a bowl. I thanked her and shook my head. In my room, I did what anyone would do. I Googled. The internet was a font of confirmation. There were options. I could be bipolar 1 or bipolar 2. Random searches told me that 60% of people with bipolar disorder are misdiagnosed, some of them for more than 10 years. That sounded like me. Though the age of onset of bipolar disorder in women was typically 20s and 30s, being diagnosed in one's 40s was common enough. I was close. I started to see the symptoms in myself. Mania meant increased activity, maybe, less need for sleep. I was a grad student, that was my special skill. Overly euphoric or irritable mood, sure, both. Risky or impulsive behaviors, I'd had sex with someone I barely knew. Racing thoughts, in spades. Rapid speech, maybe. Depression meant sadness, anxiety, feelings of guilt and worthlessness, loss of interest in life, difficulty sleeping, suicidal thoughts, yes, 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 and yes. External factors weren't to blame. I didn't use substances, which meant it couldn't be a substance abuse disorder. The idea of rejecting my diagnosis never crossed my mind. But I didn't say to myself that the psychiatrist and Dr. C could be wrong, either. I just put aside their words, my bipolar, and didn't repeat them. Not even when seated across from Angela at our next session, light streaming in from the window. 10. When the happy pill ends. The office of my new therapist, Amy, was on the 17th floor of an office building not far from the Art Institute of Chicago. Her chair was close to mine, a couple feet away, and she rested her clogs on a tiny stool. She didn't cover the gray in her hair and wore no visible makeup. She pronounced human without the H. "You're human," she'd say, which was more distracting than it should have been. I'd found her on the internet. We talked a lot about relationships. Her favorite metaphor was that of a puzzle with many pieces, each of the pieces a person in one's life. You get to decide who goes in the center and who belongs on the outer edges. I didn't ask what that meant to someone who had a puzzle with few pieces. In Iowa, the crying had eased up and the suicidal thoughts had faded by the time I received my doctorate. My move back to Chicago had been motivated by the need to be somewhere solid, familiar, home. I was staying with my mother until I found a place. I taught adjunct at two universities. Teaching constituted the majority of my social life. This didn't bother me. Solitaries like small puzzles. Mine didn't need many pieces. As with Anne and Angela, with Amy, I tended to complain a lot. Pointless, indulgent complaining. Amy always agreed with me, which I both liked and didn't. The result was often conspiratorial, the two of us judging my family and others in ways that seemed unfair. My mother knew about the suicidal thoughts and the hospital. Our relationship changed. The presumption now was that I was fragile. I'd been suicidal. Neither she nor Amy knew about the bipolar diagnosis. I couldn't pretend the months of crying and the suicidal thoughts and the hospital hadn't happened, but I wasn't ready. It was obviously more than attention deficit disorder / OCD features with some depressive, anxious elements. And my logic was starting to become circular. If I had a mental illness and it wasn't attention deficit disorder / OCD features with some depressive, anxious elements, it had to be something else because I'd been diagnosed, which meant I had to have a diagnosis. Dr. H was my first real psychiatrist. In his tiny waiting room, classical music played from a small speaker on the side table. Next to it were copies of Time. He opened the door and invited me in. I sat in a stiff armchair at one end of the room, and he in an Eames lounge chair positioned on the other. He had reddish hair and was slight of frame. He asked me questions about my diagnoses and my medications. I told him about the hospital and the psychiatrist and Dr. C. I had to tell him. What if I became suicidal again? At the end of our session, he nodded and squinched his nose as if smelling something bad. Then he said, "I may not have ADHD or OCD or depression or anxiety,
I might be bipolar. I just don't see myself as bipolar, I said. He said, no, I would put you in the category of bipolar too. I passed through the revolving doors of his office building. It was still tentative. May not have ADHD or OCD or depression or anxiety. May/may not. May, that modal verb that provided escape, not certainty. In the almost twilight, I crossed the street on Dearborn. Cars stopped at the crosswalk to let people pass. The Ritalin wasn't helping, was it? And the SSRI was, wasn't it? But three psychiatrists couldn't be wrong. The internet offered many convincing reasons to believe the psychiatrist and Dr. C and Dr. H were right. I only needed to have had one major depressive episode in my lifetime, check, and one hypomanic episode. Manic didn't sound like me, but hypomania seemed like manic light. And didn't I sometimes have inflated self-esteem? I'd thought my committee would see only good in my dissertation. Feel rested after around 3 hours of sleep? Check. Exhibit risky behavior with money? I'd also blown my savings to rehab a loft not zoned for residential and have racing thoughts? Double check. Couldn't I be more talkative than usual? I was known to talk fast. Distractible. I'd been ADHD seconds before. And overly goal-directed? Only always? Hypomania wasn't just euphoria and grandiosity. It was characterized by agitation and persistently elevated irritability, too. And weren't those terrible surges of energy agitation? And didn't I go dark for days at a time? Not depression dark. Closed off, don't come near me dark, a kind of force field that signaled to my mother to stay away. I'd be in the kitchen making my lunch for teaching the next day at one of the universities where I taught. When my mother would come in, I'd stiffen. The dark irritability force field would fill the space around me. I didn't want to be that way. After she walked out, I wanted to call after her and apologize. But it was like being trapped. WebMD and Healthline said bipolar 2 was a lesser version of bipolar 1. Very Well Mind told me I could function okay with it, which maybe I'd been able to for the most part, never having to cancel a class, never missing a deadline. Suicidality, a term I learned and started to use with frequency, was more likely in people with bipolar than in those with depression. And what if it returned? With a different diagnosis and different medications, couldn't I ensure it wouldn't? When I told my mother I was bipolar too, she looked worried. Then she said, okay, we'll do whatever we need to do. My diagnosis occurred during another DSM-driven epidemic, bipolar 2. The epidemic occurred in part because the DSM-4 relied on the defining symptom of hypomania instead of mania. In bipolar 2, hypomania is defined as 4 days of persistently elevated, expansive, or irritable mood with at least three of the following, or four if the mood was only irritability: grandiosity, decreased need for sleep, talkativeness, racing thoughts, distractibility, increased goal-directed activity or psychomotor agitation, or excessive involvement in pleasurable and risky behaviors. Researchers later found that the DSM's definition of hypomania isn't scientifically valid. Anyone can be grandiose at times. How decreased does the need for sleep have to be? Is talkativeness really a symptom? Technically, we all have racing thoughts and are distractible. Don't we praise those who are goal-oriented, particularly those who are intensely so? Doesn't the media urge us to seek out pleasurable activities, even those that might be risky? Alan Francis defended the DSM-4's broadening criteria by saying it was done to prevent patients from being diagnosed with depression, put on an antidepressant, and having a manic episode. Taking Francis's and the DSM's cue, others wanted to add yet more subtypes. Psychiatrist and researcher David Dunner argued in favor of a bipolar spectrum that included not only bipolar 2, but also bipolar 3. The psychiatrist Hagop Akiskal claimed the existence of bipolar 4. Others have said it should include sporadic brief hypomania, during which symptoms need only last for at least 1 day and occur no more than once a month. It came down to words on a page. The DSM-4's definition made it hard to distinguish between a hypomanic high and a regular old good mood that lasts 4 days.
although it did specify that hypomania is clearly different from the usual non-depressed mood. The criteria didn't specify what the difference between an episode and a usual non-depressed mood might be. After all, someone in a really good mood, or even just a good mood, might feel a decreased need for sleep, be more involved in goal-directed activity, and pursue pleasurable activities that involve risk. In the 2 decades following the publication of the DSM-IV, some urged restraint and questioned bipolar's clinical popularity, but it was too late. Drug companies seized the opportunity, advertising to consumers that any elevation in mood or irritability mixed with low mood was a sign we were bipolar. The result was overdiagnosis. Alan Francis later, too late, regretted the words that made bipolar II so easy to diagnose. But it took him 15 years to speak out. Only then did he blog, tweet, and publish articles and a book to both admit to and deny wrongdoing. In Saving Normal, he doesn't exactly offer a mea culpa. He still shirks the blame, pointing the finger at drug companies, whose purpose on this planet, as we all know and they don't deny, is to make money by getting people to take their drugs. He acknowledges the DSM-IV's role in creating the false epidemics of bipolar II, autism, and ADHD. The DSM-IV could have prevented those epidemics by requiring more symptoms of longer duration with greater impairment. His apologies are qualified with probably. The DSM-IV probably did more harm than good and could have, and probably should have, worked toward diagnostic deflation. The authors could have warned the American public of the risk of overdiagnosis and should have thought about how clinicians and others would implement the manual they'd written and should have acknowledged that 56% of the experts who worked on the DSM-IV had financial ties to drug companies. But still, Francis writes, it wouldn't have mattered. They probably couldn't have stemmed the tide of overdiagnosis. As if he could possibly know. He blames psychiatrists who treated the DSM, psychiatry's Bible, as if it were the Bible. The DSM-IV, he writes, wasn't a catalog of real diseases, just useful diagnostic constructs. After all, the co-author stated as much in the introduction. But Francis writes that he wasn't sure anyone ever reads the introduction, and few people have read, really read, the DSM's guidebook, which qualifies DSM diagnoses. He portrays himself as naive, someone who never could have guessed that the DSM-IV's loose diagnostic criteria would allow drug companies to exploit diagnoses like bipolar II. He writes this while at the same time admitting he'd witnessed how the DSM-3R caused the Prozac boom. Prozac and DSM-3R were both introduced in 1987. Prozac's sales took off at least in part because the DSM definition of major depressive disorder was so loose. The message was clear. Psychotropic drugs offered vast market potential, and sales could be greatly influenced by DSM decisions. Francis chalks up the damage caused by the DSM-IV to silly mistakes necessary to fill an important clinical niche. None of it's a very big deal. He writes, "We didn't do much harm, but we weren't of much help." Didn't do much harm. The first line of treatment was to change my medications. Dr. H took me off Ritalin, which, he said, was the worst medication someone with bipolar could be on. The week after I was off it, he said I'd stay on the SSRI. We'd add a mood stabilizer, lamotrigine, an anticonvulsant used to treat epilepsy that moonlighted as a mood stabilizer, the side effects of which included Stevens-Johnson syndrome, a reddish-purple rash that could eat my flesh and possibly kill me. He assured me it was rare. After 6 months of teaching and writing and being on lamotrigine, no flesh-eating rash had appeared. Dr. H asked how I was feeling on it. "Fine," I said, "but not that different." A squinch, a nod. "Good. That means it's working." It wasn't. After months of splintering and cracking and decidedly unstable moods, despite the mood stabilizer, I started to have panic attacks. They were unlike any I'd ever known. Deep, suffocating, vertigo-inducing. The four together, splintering, cracking, mood swings, and panic attacks, soon brought thoughts of suicide. Dr. H and I made an emergency plan. If my suicidal thoughts returned, I should go to Northwestern's inpatient psychiatric unit. This wasn't the same eating disorders unit where I'd been an outpatient as an anorexic. Northwestern's eating disorders unit had long since closed, its circular building demolished. Only the most severe eating disorder cases were treated inpatient. I asked what would happen if I went. He said its admission process was separate from the emergency rooms. I'd go right in. That was the day my mother and I wandered around in the heat looking for a non-existent separate entrance to the inpatient psych unit. I called Dr. H several times. He didn't call back. The longer we looked, the more worried my mother became. By the time we were inside the emergency room and my name had been called and the nurse had taken my blood pressure and listened to my heart and told us the psychiatric unit was a closed ward and there was no telling what hospital I'd end up in, Dr. H still hadn't called back. When my mother and I got home, she sat on the couch and I on the chair across from her. She asked how Dr. H could have been so wrong. I said I didn't know. Eventually, my cell phone rang. I told Dr. H there hadn't been a separate admissions procedure and likely the psych unit wouldn't have had any beds available. Nonplussed, he said it wasn't like that before. I could almost feel him shrug. Oh, well. He didn't apologize, just told me he hadn't had to deal with a suicidal patient in a long time. I was a particular kind of suicidal. Not suicidal like those facing end-of-life or death-with-dignity decisions. Not as someone trying to make a religious or political statement. It would have been described as despair suicidality in the sense of deaths of despair, a term coined by Anne Case and Angus Deaton at Princeton University to describe premature mortality involving drugs, alcohol, or suicide. That kind of despair, giving up, being unable to see the possibility of a positive future, can be cognitive, pessimism, worthlessness, helplessness, emotional, apathy, sadness, irritability, behavioral, self-destructive acts, recklessness, inaction, and biological, stress-related illnesses. For me, it was the result of too many days of a hopelessness so penetrating it hollowed me out. I didn't trust Dr. H anymore. It wasn't so much the inadequacy of his emergency plan. It was his ambivalence. If I was that sick, I needed the right care. After Googling for some time, I found a bipolar specialist. It seemed too good to be true, an expert in my particular illness, my diagnosis, my bipolar. Dr. M would be all to me, psychiatrist and therapist. The waiting room of his office offered filtered water and little Dixie cups. On the phone, he'd said we'd meet to determine if we were the right fit. I'd already talked myself into believing that he, the bipolar expert, would help me make sense of my life, my thoughts, my diagnosis, my mind, once and for all. The door opened. A blonde, bright but serious man poked his head out and called me in. He wore a comfy-looking cardigan sweater. His blonde hair was stiff and well-coiffed. He was young, but gave off an air of quiet confidence. I stood and followed him down a hallway of closed office doors behind which were the other psychiatrists in his practice. His office was windowless and small. I sat on the gray couch, fake leather and overly cushioned. He sat in a desk chair close by. On his desk behind him was a can of grapefruit LaCroix. It read, "Naturally essenced sparkling water." Essenced seemed to come from a place where water sparkled and nothing ever went wrong. For 40 minutes, he asked me about my mental health history and a bit about my life. I told him about the other diagnoses and the hospital in Iowa and the image of me in the bathtub in Chicago, all of it. When we finished, I asked if I was bipolar. He was the expert. He would know. Turning to his desk, he picked up the LaCroix can. I wondered if he'd mind that it was warm. He faced me again, can in hand. "Yes. I was bipolar, bipolar too." He slipped his finger under the tab and opened the can. When the scent of grapefruit reached me, it tasted of relief. That night, I filled out the life chart Dr. M assigned me. Seated at the desk in my mother's study, I colored in the graph provided, blocking out years and writing in events, shading the highs and lows that could be considered bipolar episodes. It had the look of real data, bars jutting above the zero axis, the normal axis, and others falling below it. Months when the black mass or the sodden pit was there and my mind slowed. Days and weeks when the splintering and cracking happened and I'd felt an urgent need to run or walk or dance to music only I could hear. The grandiose plans I'd had to finish my dissertation in 3 months, which I did, and still had to finish a novel in about the same amount of time, which I didn't. My life was no longer divided into weeks and months and years. It was made up of manic and depressive episodes. I leaned back in my chair and stared down at the chart. 20 years of hypomanic highs and depressive lows. 20 years of undiagnosed bipolar disorder. I put down my pen. My sessions with Dr. M revolved around my illness. His questions reframed events and interactions in terms of my bipolar. My past became reordered. Memories played at a slower or faster speed. The motivations behind this or that decision were different now that I saw them through the lens of bipolarity. He was the Sherman to my Kesa. His presence, just his presence, promised I'd never be suicidal again. The time between our sessions was interminable. Always there loomed the threat of another episode, depressive or manic, worse than the one before. Only he had the answer. With him, I managed my new life as someone with bipolar. Managed was a word I heard and read a lot. Manage meaning handle. Manage meaning cope. I learned more about bipolar disorder than any layperson should know. I subscribed to BP Hope, a magazine for people with bipolar. The My Story column featured people who revealed their long battles with bipolar disorder, a country musician, an ex-model, a lawyer. I turned page